Thank you very much. So yes, first of all, I'd like to thank David, Nicola, and Tobias, and Gunther for the invitation. It's great to be here. It's been a really interesting event already, and I'm sure the rest will be, except for the next hour and a half. Apologies for speaking in English. You wouldn't like it if I spoke in German, so... having said that, I will also sometimes speak in German, and apologies for that as well, because that'll be grotesque. So apologies for speaking in English and in German. So I'm just generally very, very sorry. Now, this is a topic that I hadn't really thought about it a great deal until a few months back. I think I'd been one of those people who tended to think of the historicity or historicality discussion towards the end of the book as, well, you know, we'll get to that someday. You know, it's a long book, you know, we're working our way towards it. And most of my work to date has been on Heidegger's work in the 1920s, and I find particularly interesting the process by which we arrive at being in time, as well as the process by which being in time begins to, as it were, come apart. And in the midst of the Heidegger affair that the Schwarze Hefte have given new life to, I confess that for me the big prize still remains Silent Days. While there are plenty of thoughts in later Heidegger that strike me as interesting and important, some of his reflections on art, language, technology and so forth, there are also many that I simply don't feel I understand, let alone believe. I do think, on the other hand, that I have some idea of what's going on in Sein und Zeit, and it's to those ideas whose supposed contamination by Nazi or proto-Nazi thought that concerns me most, as those thoughts seem to me to be profound and important. For that reason, I'm going to take the opportunity provided by this conference to look back at that book with an eye to such contamination. In some respects, I have to confess, I think my views of the broader Heidegger affair are probably not that interesting, to be honest, because I think I share views expressed already and better by others. So one such view is Safranski's, that Heidegger's political actions were those of a philosophical dreamer who constructed an entire imaginary philosophical stage for the historical happening of Nazis. Another, which one sees in work of, say, Hans Sluger and Julian Jung, is that philosophical views inevitably underdetermine political views. The loosened of fit between the former and the latter, reflecting the former's naturally greater degree of abstraction. So Marcuse famously wrote to Heidegger that though he admired him as a philosopher, we cannot make the separation between Heidegger the philosopher and Heidegger the man, for it contradicts his own philosophy. But as we'll see, that philosophy specifically requires such a separation, in that a certain abstraction defines the existential analytic of Sein und Zeit. For that reason alone, any attempt, even say by Heidegger himself, to demonstrate the relevance of his thought to the kinds of commitments that we now associate with Nazism would seem to need to go far beyond what that book has to offer. Among the striking features of the Schwarze Hefte are the remarks that suggest for Heidegger, to echo Peter Gordon, the Jews became a philosophical category. So to echo Fave, race seemingly somehow having been introduced into Heidegger's philosophy. When, for example, he speaks of the Jews with their marked gift for calculation, calculation being obviously a significant category in Heidegger's later reflections on technology. But ingenious hermeneutics aside, it seems prima facie that in Sein und Zeit, the Jews are not a philosophical category. But I want to take the opportunity here to look back again at the respects in which that book might seem to provide the basis for just sow the seeds of relevant political commitments. The obvious starting points are, as my title suggests, his reflections on authenticity and history. Authenticity because those reflections seem prescriptive and at least to border on moral reflection, and history because those reflections may seem to identify sources of substantive prescriptions. As is well known, Heidegger also told Carl Lewith in 1936, that his commitment to historicality was the basis of his political commitment. So what I want to do here is, in a way, sort of take us back to where all the trouble supposedly began. Now, what I'll do here is report some modest observations of mine about these reflections and on my attempts to understand them. I'll make two main points. The first is that we have a serious paucity of evidence if we wish to demonstrate a substantive reading of what appear to be the key concepts in the historicality discussion. The paper trail, so to speak, for these alluring concepts, there are certain concepts that I'll focus on, I think everybody does, because they immediately grab your attention when you read the crucial section. So when we really read these alluring concepts, Erbe, Heild, Geschicht, Schicksal, and Volk, which Heidegger discusses so briefly in Sein und Zeit, that paper trail is itself actually remarkably faint. My second point is that it is reflections on the history of philosophy, where Heidegger's reflections on history really come alive. But it's anything but clear how one might generalize from this single example of how one might relate authentically or inauthentically to one's history to the kind of general account of such a relation that Sein und Zeit's brief discussion of historicality promises. Though I will make some suggestions, some tentative suggestions at the end about how maybe that project's not quite as doomed as it might seem. So my section one, authenticity, temporality, and historicality. Now, saying something useful in a short period of time about the discussion of authenticity is difficult, because that discussion is elaborate and complex and itself presupposes much. Saying something useful in a similar period about the discussion of historicity is difficult because that discussion is short, taking up only 6 of Sein und Zeit's 437 pages, and itself presupposes an understanding of Heidegger's understanding of authenticity and temporality. So, for example, Heidegger declares that when authentic, the present is not only brought back from distraction with the objects of one's closest concern, but it gets held in the future in having been. Out of this vision of a temporal interpretation of authenticity grows the discussion of historicity. The interpretation of Dasein's historicity, the term is Geschichtlichkeit, obviously, Macquarie and Robinson translated as historicality. That seems to be falling out of favour and everybody's saying historicity. So what I've decided to do here is inconsistently go back and forward between the two of them. So apologies for that. I've just realised that that's what I'm doing. So out of this vision of a temporal interpretation of authenticity grows this discussion of history. The interpretation, Heidegger says, the interpretation of Dasein's historicality is at bottom just a more concrete working out of temporality, which, he explains, we first revealed with regard to that way of existing authentically which we characterised as anticipatory resolution. In this discussion, Heidegger makes a case for seeing Dasein's existing as geschehen. This term, which ordinarily means no more than to happen or to occur. But Macquarie and Robinson render it as historicize on the grounds that Heidegger stresses the etymological connection with Geschichte, with history. It's stressing that and how, as his translators also say, Dasein happens in a historical way. And what I'll on the couple of occasions where this word crops up, I'll talk about historical happening. Among the points Heidegger wishes to make is that, in that discussion, is to insist that Dasein's most fundamental relation to history is not that which is exhibited in what he calls historiology, as Macquarie and Robinson put it, historiography, as Stambaugh puts it. So that's history as the science of history. And here we see a move familiar from elsewhere in Sein und Zeit in the early work, the insistence that a form of Wissenschaft must not be mistaken for Dasein's fundamental relation to the domain that that Wissenschaft concerns, a relation that indeed makes possible that Wissenschaft. It's section 74 of Sein und Zeit that addresses the title of which is The Basic Constitution of Historicality. So that seems to be the key section. What it adds to Heidegger's earlier discussion of temporality appears to turn on several seemingly key terms, you know, Erbe, Schicksal, Geschicht, Held, Volk. These terms seem to glow with a kind of Orphic power. They seem to intimate a deeper meaning that might rank them alongside key Heideggerian concepts like being towards death, anxiety, guilt, conscience, etc. So, for example, when first introduced, the first three, Erbe, Schicksal, Geschicht, they're italicized, they immediately jump out at you on the page. It looks like you're meant to, as it were, your eye is meant to be captured by these terms. The fourth, Held, is presented through the striking formulation that Dasein may choose its hero, its Held. The fifth, Folk, is introduced with much less fanfare, and one might well wonder whether the importance of that term in Heidegger's own eyes matches that which we, his post-World War II readers, see in it retrospectively. Either way, the power of it and these other terms is without doubt Orphic. You know, their deeper meaning, should there be one, is no more than intimated. So what are we to make of these terms? Well, first a few words on authenticity. So to set the stage for looking at these five Orphic words of power, Heidegger presents a summary of where his reflections on authenticity have taken us up to that point. Central to this, of course, is the notion of anticipatory resolution for Laufender and Schlossenheit. A running ahead resolution come openness. In this mode of existence, what Dasein runs ahead to is death, and what it's open to is its factical there, its concrete situation. Now, these are murky matters about which I've said quite a lot elsewhere. Here I will devote to them all of three paragraphs. Not, of course, to persuade you to see them the same way, but just to give you a sense of how I'm inclined to approach the discussion of history and why it represents a bit of a problem for the kind of view, at least on the face of it, represents a bit of a problem for the way in which I'm inclined to think about these matters. So I've argued elsewhere that authentic being towards death issues in one's attending oneself to one's own present situation. Authenticity is, as I put it, a matter of owning one's own judgment, such that one acts now on the basis of one's own evaluation of how one ought to act. This condition is at the same time a certain way of relating to one's own death. How so? Well, failure to own one's judgment issues in the need, as Heidegger puts it, to push away death into the realm of postponement. Because that failure entails the possibility that one's life, by one's own lights, needs, as it were, fixing. In the eyes of those who fail, there must still be plenty of time, Heidegger says. And only the authentic can, in contrast, as he says, endure the possibility of death. The possibility that death can come at any moment, that certain indefiniteness that gives death its sting, as he says in lectures. The authentic who live in line with their own assessment of what is right are, in this sense, free for death. Free for the possibility that they will simply be what they are now and no more. In a way that the inauthentic, who by virtue of living instead in line with Das Man's assessment of what is right, are not living as themselves, are not living as they themselves would judge they should. They, correspondingly, are not free for death. As well, there has to be more time. There has to be the possibility to be, as well, more than, other than they are now. To live in the light of death's certain indefiniteness is to set to work now and always one's own judgment. And such an anticipation of death calls for Entschlossenheit in the double sense in which Heidegger seems to have intended. One is resolute in being true to one's own judgment, and one is that by attending to the situation one finds oneself in. To be true to one's own judgment is to be open to look oneself at what here and now can and must be done. When one summons oneself back, as Heidegger puts it, to what is happening around one here and now, one confronts a further face of one's finitude, which Heidegger calls guilt. One finds oneself in a context of possibilities which one did not oneself will into existence, were thrown into a range of possibilities that Dasein constantly lags behind, and from amongst which, in acting or in refusing to act, we can and must select only one. So he says, freedom is only in the choice of one possibility, that is, in tolerating one's not having chosen the others and one's not being able to choose them. Now, how I fill out this sketch is not something I can explain here, nor should it seem fanciful, is here the place to convince you otherwise. But let me identify a problem which the history discussion may seem to pose for us, which my reading throws into relief. For my reading, authenticity, an authentic being towards death, is setting one's judgment to work here and now. One of the benefits of this reading, it seems to me, is that it explains what, in Heidegger's words, death and the concrete situation of taking action can have in common. So, you know, there's a common worry that authenticity requires you in a way to sort of turn your attention away from engaged activity in the world around you. But this seems to, some people worry it's requires a certain kind of paralysis, a certain kind of stepping away from the actual living of your life. I think one of the benefits of the reading that I've got is it says the reverse. So I think it addresses this worry about what can death and the situation of action have in common. A problem that the history discussion poses is what can history and the concrete situation of taking action have in common? So try and bear that in mind as we move on. Because on the face of it, the notion that you should be authentically historical seems to say, on the face of it and crudely, it looks like it's in a way directing your attention away from, as it were, the here and now. So let's look at the discussion of section 74. Here Heidegger elaborates on how anticipatory resolution, through it one comes back to one's factical there, as he says. In the state, he says, and this is, I'm sort of splicing together a few quotes from this passage, in the state, Dasein will go right under the eyes of death in order thus to take over in its thrownness that entity which it is itself. This resolute taking over of one's factical there, Dasein being pushed into its finitude in projecting itself upon its own being guilty, means at the same time, den Entschluss in der Situation, deciding, as I see it, on what one's situation calls for through one's own openness to its possibilities and to the need to decide. So Heidegger says, if Dasein by anticipation lets death become powerful in itself, then as free for death, Dasein understands itself in its own superior power, Übermacht, the power of its finite freedom, so that in this freedom, which is only in its having chosen to make such a choice, it can take over the powerlessness, Ohnmacht, of being abandoned to itself and come to have a clear vision for the accidents of the situation that has been disclosed. What we seem to be being invited to envisage here is Dasein's coming to see the true range of possibilities for action within which it finds itself and from which it will choose in acting, as opposed to merely continuing by accident, as it were, in the particular furrows that Das Man condones. Dasein lost, as Heidegger puts it, in the possibilities which circulate in the average public way of interpreting Dasein today. What then is this broader range of possibilities? Heidegger clearly states that in the existential analytic, we cannot in principle discuss what Dasein factically resolves in any particular case. Nevertheless, he says, we must ask whence in general Dasein can draw these possibilities upon which it factically projects itself. In other words, pace Marcuse, it's key rather than contradictory to the work of Heidegger the philosopher that he separate out his own proper concerns from those of Heidegger the man. It's no concern of the existential analytic to consider the particular possibilities that Dasein might act upon, but only whence in general they come. And it's into this discussion that Heidegger begins to introduce the Orphic terms. So he says, the resoluteness in which Dasein comes back to itself discloses current factical possibilities of authentic existing and discloses them from out of the heritage, aus dem Erbe, which that resoluteness as throne takes over. Resolute coming back to one's own, to one's thrownness, he says, harbours within itself a handing down to oneself, sich überliefern, of the possibilities that have come down to one. And here Heidegger introduces perhaps our trickiest term, Schicksal. He says, once one has grasped the finitude of one's existence, it snatches one back from the endless multiplicity of possibilities which offer themselves as closest to one, those of comfortableness, shirking, and taking things lightly, and brings Dasein into the simplicity of its fate, Schicksals. This is how we designate Dasein's primordial historical happening, which lies in authentic resoluteness and in which Dasein hands itself down to itself, free for death, in a possibility that it has inherited and yet has chosen. Now from here, Heidegger moves quickly to address two possible misunderstandings of this fate. Firstly, he distinguishes Schicksal from any notion of fate as that which merely happens to befall a person, from the fortunate circumstances which come Dasein's way and the cruelty of chance, as he says. Secondly, he rejects what one might call an individualistic construal of Schicksal, and here we encounter two more Orphic terms. If fateful, Dasein, as being in the world, exists essentially in being with others, its historical happening is a co-happening, and is determined as destiny, as Geschicht. This is how we designate the historical happening of the community, of a people, der Gemeinschaft, des Volks. Now, what explicitly drives these thoughts is the familiar idea that Dasein's world is a with world, that our basic experience of that world is of a world shared with others. No more than our understanding of that world arises out of a bringing together of many understandings independently realized in individuals. With destiny, Geschicht, this is not put together out of individual fates, he says, out of individual Schicksalen. Instead, fates, Schicksalen, have already been guided in advance in our being with one another in the same world, he says. So these terms, they're playing on the notion of sending, Schicken. Here, Heidegger insisting the being sent that is one's Schicksal is in fact a co-sending, Geschicht. Our last Orphic term arises on the following page, where in a passage I will quote at length, Heidegger sets to work the notion of Wiederholung, repetition, or more etymologically, a fetching back. So he says it's in Dasein's temporality, and there only, that there lies any possibility that the existential potentiality for being upon which it projects itself can be gleaned explicitly from the way in which Dasein has been traditionally understood. The resoluteness which comes back to itself and hands itself down then becomes the repetition of a possibility of existence that has come down to us. Repetition is handing down explicitly. That is to say, going back into the possibilities of the Dasein that has been there. The authentic repetition of a possibility of existence that has been, the possibility that Dasein may choose its hero, is grounded existentially in anticipatory resolution, or resoluteness. For it's in resoluteness that one first chooses the choice which makes one free for the struggle of loyally following in the footsteps of that which can be repeated. Now, as I'll discuss below, one might well wonder what section 74 is meant to have added to Heidegger's discussion preceding it. I'll come back to that. I'll talk about deflationary reading. I'll come back to that in a moment. To get to the point where we can ask that question, I want to make some preliminary observations. The first concerns the passage just quoted from Zeit 385. Now, one might see in that passage, well, that passage is the kind of passage which naturally sets twitching the antennae of the Nazi hunting reader. So if you put it alongside the kinds of remarks about fate and destiny, fate and the destiny of a people, which readily brings to mind the rectoral address, 1933. Add to that this talk of repetition and choosing a hero in whose footsteps one might loyally follow. Understandably, one might give the impression that the authentic are in some way subservient to, restricted by, bound by the possibilities and heroes that their heritage makes available to them. And a species of conservatism or chauvinism or Nazism seems to be in the offing. Now, I think that's a superficial reading for a number of different reasons. One is well known from Julian Jung's work, namely that it all depends on how one tells one's history. So Heidegger's heritage, arguably also including bases, not only is there a European tradition of anti-Semitism, but arguably Heidegger's heritage also includes the bases for egalitarian human rights based thought. So, this is Jung's point. It all depends on how you think the history actually shakes out. But I want to offer some more reasons for thinking it's a superficial reading, which might not seem very interesting themselves, but they'll get us to somewhere hopefully a bit more interesting. Firstly, the mode of relating to one's past that Heidegger describes using these terms, repetition and choosing one's heroes, is, we need to know, it's explicitly one form that the authentic handing down of possibilities can take, that of doing so explicitly. So when Dasein realizes the possibility of projecting itself upon an existential potentiality for being gleaned explicitly from the way in which Dasein has been traditionally understood, such resoluteness then becomes repetition, he says. We should also note that the sentence which precedes the passage that I quoted, it's at the start of the passage on your handout, reads, "It's not necessary that in resoluteness one should explicitly know the origin of the possibilities upon which the resoluteness projects itself." Secondly, we're not given much of a sense here of why one ought, if indeed one ought, to engage in such forms of repetition. Heidegger's point in this passage instead seems to be to insist that the possibility of explicitly handing down, and of its instance that is loyally fetching back a hero, lies in Dasein's temporality. In line with the discussion of historiology already mentioned, being historical in the sense of explicitly following a possibility realized or an exemplar to be found in one's community's history presupposes the more ursprüngliche Geschehen that is Dasein's ecstatic openness to its past. Such repetition and loyalty depends on a form of historiology that cannot be seen as Dasein's most fundamental relationship to history. And none of this entails that authenticity requires repetition in the sense of handing down explicitly, let alone loyally following heroes. Other related passages fit this reading. Heidegger's description quoted above of coming back resolutely to one's thrownness as harbouring within itself a handing down to oneself of the possibilities that have come down to one continues, but not necessarily as having thus come down. Nor have we here a reason for handing down explicitly or loyally following heroes. Similarly, on page 396, Heidegger states that when the possible is made one's own by repetition, there is adumbrated at the same time the possibility of reverently preserving the existence that has been there. But this occurs in the course of a discussion of historiology and explicitly concerns repetition, the handing down of possibilities explicitly. And this passage also says nothing about whether one ought to reverently preserve the existence that has been there. To press this point home, let's also note that Heidegger stresses that even such explicit repetition of a possibility need not take the form of its being actualized over again, as he says. Nor does repetition, as he says, abandon itself to that which is past. Rather, it makes, this Macquarie and Robertson's version, it makes a reciprocative rejoinder to that possibility. It erwidert, replies, responds, even makes a retort to that possibility. It's my understanding that that's fair to the German, so it's good to see at least one person nodding. Everybody else sitting there, just whatever. So the range of, as well, rejoinders, the range of, you know, the term repetition, you might well say it's a rather odd rendering of the idea. And for that reason, it's kind of understandable that, for instance, Husserl, in his marginal notes on the on this passage, writes, "And so, no repetition after all." And indeed, you know, might not liberal egalitarian thinking erwidert a racist, say, an anti-Semitic heritage? Moreover, to raise a point which will be important later, we still have little of sense of what non-explicit handing down of possibilities is going to be like. So that'll come back. So we've heard a lot about explicit handing down of possibilities, not much about non-explicit handing down of possibilities. Now, my second preliminary observation concerns Das Volk. By way of reminder, Heidegger says that destiny, Geschichte, designates the historical happening of the community, of a people, der Gemeinschaft, des Volks. But the historical happening of a fateful individual, Dasein, is itself also determined as Geschichte, by virtue of our being with one another in the same world, he says. But what does this grounding consideration show? It may entail that we belong to a Gemeinschaft, but does that mean we belong to a Volk? In English, at least, a people might denote the English, the Germans, the French, etc. One's Gemeinschaft might be a Volk in this sense, but equally it might not. Arguably, most of us do not live in a Gemeinschaft which is ein Volk. Either way, this would seem to be an empirical fact of the sort that the existential analytic would not in principle discuss, an existentiel rather than existential matter. What's hard to see here is a basis for thinking that my Schicksal is not only a co-sending, a Geschicht, with other people, but also with a people. Now, is this then a criticism of Heidegger? Well, that depends on how much importance he attaches to the single occurrence of this word Volk, one word out of Sein und Zeit's 140,000 or so words. Now, there are plenty of other puzzles that Section 74 raises, and we'll come back to one later on, but I now want to turn to my third preliminary observation. This concerns not so much the section itself, but rather one of the obvious ways in which one might attempt to address some of the puzzles that it raises. As I've suggested, it's difficult to know quite what to make of some of these seemingly key concepts which are so briefly discussed. But of course, we're often in that kind of position with a work like Zeit und Zeit. There are lots of concepts and claims that are puzzling. And the subsequent publication of Heidegger's lectures and other writings from the period provides you one way of addressing that kind of puzzlement. We trace the paper trail, so to speak, for these concepts and claims. You get a sense of what originally motivated them and other perspectives on how Heidegger might have understood them. And this is an approach which bears fruit with many of the concepts that populate Heidegger's discussion of authenticity, for example. So one can trace back to writings at the very beginning of the 1920s, concepts like anticipation, resolution, being towards death, averageness, falling, das Mann, and so forth. So when faced with Erbe, Geschicht, Held, Schicksal, and Volk, it'd be natural to look to that paper trail to find where Heidegger discusses them. But having made a reasonably thorough search, I can't claim to have been totally comprehensive through the works of the 1920s, credit here to the Heidegger Concordance people, my most striking finding is just how thin that paper trail is. To begin with, our Orphic terms are absent from those discussions that might most plausibly be seen as drafts of section 74. So the chapter entitled Temporality and Historicity in the Concept of Time Review article uses only one of our key words, Schicksal, and only once, and seemingly in its mundane, as it were, non-Orphic sense. And the same is true of the single use of Volk, to be found in the Cassell lectures discussion of historicality. Now, one does, of course, find these terms used in other texts, but again in what very much seem to be their ordinary rather than their Orphic senses. Held, one hardly finds used at all, and never, as far as I can see, in a way that would support an Orphic reading, as I'm putting it, of its two uses in Zeit und Zeit. Erbe, too, is used very infrequently and mostly in a mundane way, as, for example, when Heidegger encourages his contemporaries to engage with the heritage, in English we'd probably more idiomatically say legacy, of Diltai and York. But there are some interesting uses. Heidegger mentions Erbe in quotes in some rather telegraphic handwritten notes on the basic concepts of Aristotelian philosophy lectures, which go on to talk about the possibility of saving or cultivating that which is given in advance, he says, and of language as possession, inheritance. You get a little dash, he says, possibility of abuse, decline. Another interesting case to which we will return is in the Basic Problems lectures, 1928 Basic Problems, in the discussion of the thesis that essence and existence belong to every entity. There, Heidegger claims that to understand this thesis and its significance, we must understand the Greeks better than they understand themselves. Only then, he says, shall we be in possession of our heritage. I think a little pattern is going to, as it were, begin here, as we'll see. Volk, too, is rarely used, and when used, is used in mundane ways. For example, when Heidegger talks of the Greeks like all southern peoples, or the people meaning persons of average sophistication. That's from the Sophist lectures. You also get the word used for swarms of bees in the Fundamental Concepts lectures. So none of his texts from the 1920s make significant use of this term Volk, which I think has to be significant, with one exception to which we will come back. Now, Geschicht is also rarely used. The most uses seem to be mundane, though a pattern of interest, I think, is emerging when we read of ontology's destiny and the destiny of philosophy. One noteworthy case is in the Fundamental Concepts lectures where he uses Geschicht where the regimentation envisaged in Zeit und Zeit would precisely seem to require Schicksal. So he talks there of the Geschicht of each individual human being. Now, Schicksal itself is used much more frequently, but again, very largely in mundane ways. For example, when he talks of the fate of Aristotelian research. He talks about anecdotes about the lives and fates of the ancient thinkers. We also encounter cases where, as with the use of Geschicht in Fundamental Concepts, Heidegger seems to violate the regimentation of Zeit und Zeit. So in the introduction to philosophy lectures, for example, he talks of das Schicksal eines Menschen und eines Volkes. But among the mundane uses to which I alluded, we find again the interesting pattern that I identified above, or hinted at so far, We find talk of the fate of philosophy, the fate of logic, the fate of philosophizing. So what I'm going to suggest later to get, you know, to stop being so so precious about it is philosophy seems to be the notion around which ideas of fate, Geschicksal and so forth, revolves. As opposed to as with the utter generality with which these terms seem to be presented in section 74. So how then are you to proceed? Well, you might go for what I mentioned before, a kind of deflationary reading. Try and say, well, you know, there's really not that much more going on in the section 74 discussion than we already have in the discussions of thrownness and guilt. And, you know, when he says things like the interpretation of Dasein's historicality, is at bottom just a more concrete working out of temporality? You know, that might encourage that thought. The very fact that the discussion is so short might encourage that kind of thought. Heidegger does talk of authentic historicality as making possible, for instance, a critique of the present. But those kinds of remarks, too, can be accommodated by a kind of deflationary reading. Through Heidegger's earlier depiction of inauthentic everydayness as Dasein's living unto the day, as living in the light of whatever the day may bring. If you can just try and remember those formulations, because they're going to pop up later in an interesting place. Living unto the day is in den Tag hinein lebt, and living in the light of whatever the day may bring, was je gerade den Tag bringst. So, you know, on the face of it, you might, if you're feeling bold, you might think you can produce this, as were, this deflationary reading. Another, you know, worry you might have about this is that one of the features of the discussion of historicality is that what Heidegger does is he draws on a familiar picture from earlier parts of Sein und Zeit and elsewhere of inauthenticity as are coming under the influence of a way in which things are generally understood that's embodied in the work of Das Man, one that we generally don't appropriate and which embodies a species of shallow, even he says sometimes pseudo, understanding. And in his discussions of history too, he presents this pseudo-understanding. What we see there is he presents it as an unrecognized historical inheritance. So he talks about, he says, we are loaded down by a past which has become unrecognizable. But again, you know, a deflationist might try and argue, well, you know, how much work is this? Are these allusions to history really doing? And a further advantage of that kind of reading, for those who would defend Heidegger against the charge that he lays a basis for conservatism or chauvinism, is that the reading allows us to fall back, as it were, to Heidegger's earlier account of thrownness and guilt. If his critics want to attack him by attacking that, then they would seem to need to attack some deeply plausible claims merely about the finitude of human existence. So, despite the appeal of the, as it were, deflationary approach, I think the fact remains that Heidegger does think his reflections on historicality add to that earlier account, though in a way which I think is problematic. It's tricky for us. To bring this problem out, let's look at what I think is the most important discussion to be found in the paper trail of Heidegger's general reflections on historicality. For this, we must return to the very beginning of the 1920s and part one of Heidegger's lectures entitled Phenomenology of Intuition and Expression. So let's set the scene by just mentioning again another puzzle from section 74 of Sein und Zeit. There Heidegger announces rather out of the blue that the inauthentic have no fate. Now this unexplained remark jars in that the historicality that the concept of Schicksal articulates would seem to be an existential structure, not something Dasein could fail to have. In the 1920 lectures, in reflecting on what he calls the problem of the a priori, Heidegger there distinguishes a number of senses of history and of how we may have history. In a way for which familiarity with Sein und Zeit makes us ready, Heidegger distinguishes there between history as science of history and other more primordial senses, in the course of that discussion, we encounter what he calls historyless tribes and peoples. So folk looms here. So who are these historyless peoples? It's not that such peoples lack a science of history, he said, or that nothing happened to them in earlier times. Rather, This is from the this is on your handout. They have no tradition. They do not feel as the later ones of earlier ones. The past is not a character in which they factically live and which somehow permeates the content of their life experience. They do not cultivate the past. The historyless tribes do not live in situations that are pervaded by estimations and the inclusion of the meaningful past into the factical circle of life, even if only latently and by habit. They live each day as it comes, leben jeden Tag in den Tag hinein, according to what the day may bring, was der Tag eben bringt. This contrasts with what he calls a history-having people, whose past is, he says, preserved, upheld, and cultivated. Such a preserving is, anticipating the later notion of Geschicht, very much the preserving of a shared tradition. He says, it's a preserving of the formed environing world, the determinate with-world, and the forms of with-living and with-world-having. Such preserving is also clearly no mere abandonment to that which is past. Rather, he says, it involves a continually newly taking over and taking along in one's own Dasein. In this way, he says, one, as it were, lives in one's own tradition, which Dasein gives to itself. So he says, this is on your handout, in this sense of concurrently being there, of concurrently playing a role, of concurrently occurring in the factical world of experience, the past, respectively as continuous renewal according to tradition, co-constitutes actual Dasein. He says, and this isn't on your handout, but I think it's an important line, through this relationship, he says, the past is concurrently there in the ambit of the concrete situation of actual Dasein and plays a determining role in it. So on the face of it, you might think, here we have the answer to our earlier question, that question about, what does history and the concrete situation of action have in common? So the past history here, it's there in the ambit of the concrete situation of Dasein. But what is the answer? It sounds like an answer, but what is the answer meant to be? Despite the promise, I think, of identifying this earlier discussion, in some respects, I think it doesn't really move us on that significantly. Primarily because it still remains less than clear what such preserving and cultivating involves, what it looks like, if you like. Hadier consistently maintains that saying historyless people do not know their past misses his meaning, he says. He says, for one can have a very rich tradition, i.e. one can live out of it and from it, without actually knowing the past as a subject matter. He also denounces cultivation which is, quote, purposefully organized in a detached way. He denounces that as already having become ungenuine. And one can see why this might be so. In distinguishing another sense of history, what he calls history as life's great instructor, Heidegger insists that if, say, a politician were continuously occupied with the past, that would make political activity impossible in his own present. So in place of that kind of disengaging distraction, if you like, a preserved tradition has to be concurrently there in the ambit of the concrete situation of actual Dasein. But what does that look like? These sentiments anticipate, obviously, Heidegger's later insistence that authentic historicality does not necessarily require historiology. But it leaves us wondering what it does require. What we need, one might say, are examples. And Heidegger does provide us with one. But unfortunately, it's always the same one. And not, on the face of it at least, I think, a particularly promising one with respect to our present puzzle. Just what this kind of, as it were, non-historiological preserving of tradition would be like. What I'm going to suggest is that, in line with Safranski's expression earlier on, Heidegger is a philosophical dreamer, and in a way connects to something that Sasha said yesterday as well. Here too, in Heidegger's reflections on history, everything revolves around philosophy. We always come back to philosophy. So, for example, in the Cassell lectures, we find echoes of the kind of preservation alluded to in the 1920 Intuition and Expression lectures. He says, in disclosing the past in a primordial manner, the past is no longer seen to be merely a present that preceded our own present. Rather, it's possible to emancipate the past so that we can find in it the authentic roots of our existence and bring it into our own present as a vital force. Historical consciousness liberates the past for the future, and it's then that the past gains force and becomes productive. Then, as he says, to bring home the meaning of historical research and its possibilities, he tells us we choose as our example the history of philosophy. Indeed, what one finds is that in all of the discussions to which we've alluded, if perhaps less obviously in Zion-Zeit, but maybe it is obvious in Zion-Zeit, it's this example that's always right round the corner. So, for example, the concept of time review article discussion immediately turns in a familiar way from Zion-Zeit to a destruction of Christian anthropology, Descartes' debts to medieval ontology, and the roots of that in the concept of being found in Greek ontology. The intuition and expression discussion, too, emerges out of a discussion of the idea of a phenomenological destruction. And as I have observed above, the paper trail of other uses of Schicksal and Geschick takes us repeatedly through discussions of philosophy's fate, the destiny of philosophizing. And when Heidegger turns to such matters, we not only encounter the themes that inform his general discussions of historicality, but it seems to me that they take on a much more readily grasped content. In a way, it should come as no surprise whatsoever that it should be Heidegger's own acute sense of standing in a complex, misunderstood, but deeply powerful tradition as a philosopher that drives his reflections on history and the relations which we can bear to it. So, I give you an example on the handout. It's a nice passage from the Introduction to Phenomenological Research lectures where we see this kind of point come out. We see lots of the kind of those themes from the quite general remarks on historicality, but you can you can see what lies behind them. You can see the particular example that's as we're breathing life into those reflections. But I'll let you read that at your own leisure, since I know I'm going on a bit. But now, having identified this one, recognised the fact that, yes, he does give us an example, but it's always the same example, we seem to be left with two difficulties. The first one is just figuring out what kind of work Heidegger's destruction was to have performed, because it's not as if that's transparent. The second is figuring out just how one moves from that vision of preserving, cultivating a philosophical tradition to produce the kind of seemingly quite general account that section 74 of Zion-Zeit and the intuition and expression lectures seem to envisage. So you might say, yeah, great, we've finally got an example, but how special an example is it? How easy is it going to be to extrapolate from that particular kind of example to the kind of general account that Heidegger seems to be promising us? Now, this latter project might seem to be doomed. In particular, how can we shed light on the kind of non-historiological, authentic historicality that Heidegger seems to envisage? How can we do that by generalising from what would seem to be the archly historiological exercise of doing the history of philosophy? But I think, actually, the version of the paper that I had, I think, 48 hours ago, basically, pretty well ended there. But since then, something about your warm, encouraging presence has made me think, maybe we can take a couple of steps here. And one turns on having a little bit of a think about just what the destruction of the ontological tradition looks like. So let's start with that. As I say, prospects might look bleak because Heidegger's historical destruction is historiological. But it's not merely historiological. Its point, surely, is not to provide us with historiological knowledge of philosophy's past, but to change how we philosophize here and now. And in particular, to show us that there are possibilities for us as philosophers now that our philosophical today, with its inauthentic past, covers up. As Heidegger says in lectures around the publication of Zion-Zeit, he says, we are going to concern ourselves with history not out of some interest in antiquity, say to know what Aristotle thought. No, the historical questions that we ask should confront us with ourselves and force us to enter our own history. He says, we wish to revive not Aristotle, not the ontology of the Middle Ages, neither Kant nor Hegel, but only ourselves. That is to say, we wish to emancipate ourselves from the phraseology and conveniences of the present, which reels from one fickle fashion to the next. So, for example, we come to see that skepticism rests on an at least challengeable ontology. We come to see that the essence-existence distinction, understood as universal, is universal only on the basis of another at least challengeable ontology. As well, there are more options, there are greater freedoms out there that we come to discern. There are greater freedoms, as well, for us, within our tradition, that we come to discern through this kind of historiological work, and that can then inform the way in which we philosophize now, not when we're reading Aristotle, but so, you know, in some sense, as we philosophize in the here and now. I mean, there are some crudities in that, but let's just say it for now. Now, I think there are two important points here. One concerns the issue we've just been confronting, this question about, you know, what is this kind of, or what is authentic historicality that isn't the form, doesn't come in the form of just doing some historiology? And the other takes us back to the worry about conservatism and chauvinism and so forth. So firstly, we see, I think, in the historical destruction, in as much as we can see it, given that it wasn't, in some sense, wasn't completed, we see a historiological process which results in our seeing here and now, latent in our concrete situation, you might say, a wider range of possibilities. Moreover, it seems to me this does seem to be something we could generalise from. We might have a stab at generalising from this. So I've got a little example here. For example, one could imagine an education in the history of chess that merely yielded knowledge that on such a date, Kasparov did this, and on this date, Spassky did that. But such an education could also lead one to see possibilities in a game one is playing right now that would otherwise have remained hidden, though that history, when unknown, may already be shaping how one has learnt to play. But once educated in that history, the past of the game now is latent for one in one's concrete situation. The tradition is preserved, you might say, handed down in one's broadened understanding of possibilities here and now. And they may do so without explicit repetition in the sense defined in section 74. There need not be any explicit reflective choosing of Kasparov as one's hero. In this sense, such authentic historicality would not be historiological, but it could be brought about by a process that involves historiology, in both respects not dissimilar to Heidegger's recurrent and only example, the historical destruction of the ontological tradition. The second point is that this process is, parte the conservatism-chauvinism charge, it's a process that he describes, and I think with some justification, as one of emancipation, of preserving possibilities that will otherwise be lost, and hence expanding our freedom. We must recall that, you know, what's the contrast case here? It's inauthentic historicality. What does that look like? Well, that's a condition in which one is, as he says, absorbed in objects of one's closest concern. When inauthentic possibilities are dimmed down and entities returned to their... entities revealed to those closest concerns are taken to be the real world, he says, full stop. So as it were, possibility dims down, and the way in which we're dealing with entities right now according to our closest concerns seems to be just to be dealing with, well, with just the real world, that which is just there. There is then at least an irony, it seems to me, in the conservatism charge when raised specifically in connection with this historicality discussion. From this point of view, the inauthentic are the ones who have fewer options. And being, as he puts it, forced to enter our own history actually reawakens questions, possibilities, options instead. So I think Heidegger's reflections on how the philosopher ought to relate to his history may yet tell us something about a broader relation to history. But what we don't see in Sein und Zeit, it seems to me, is anything like a serious working out of such a more general view. That work has been, as well, has not been done for us by Heidegger. And he himself gives us some reasons to wonder how easy it's going to be to fill out that kind of sketch that I've given. So in the Basic Problems lectures, for example, he says that the possibilities and feints of ontology are bound up with temporality and with historicality in a more original sense than any other science. And you might well think that if, as it were, we're going to struggle to generalise from ontology to other sciences, it's going to be even more tricky when we generalize outside of Wissenschaft altogether, you might say. So it's possible, it seems to me, we have to retain the worry that our envisaged projection of a general account from this example is going to be bedeviled by starting with what is, in fact, a very special case. I just want to finish with a tentative thought on an issue that emerged yesterday in Gunther's discussion. The question of the emergence of a more collectivist mode of thought in Heidegger. So this is just something that, having written what I wrote, I just thought, well, there might be some kind of connection, who knows. The model of preservation and cultivation that I've sketched above suggests that work is, one might say, if I can find what I say next. One might say, is a kind of cultural or at least an educational feat. The bringing of individuals to see possibilities that only a history-having people achieves. And now that view might well seem to rival another, perhaps more individualistic model of what it is to recognize the range of possibilities that concrete situations offer to one, the one that I described earlier. It's a certain kind of, as it were, turning your attention back to the situation you find yourself on, you find yourself in. Maybe sort of, relinquishing that focus on the object of closest concern, perhaps through some readiness for anxiety or the call of conscience, however you want to fill it out. And in a way, you as it were, become aware, you recognize the range of options that are actually open to you in your situation in the here and now. But from the point of view of the kind of collectivist, as it were, educational, cultural model that I was just describing, there might seem to be a certain naivety in that individualistic model. An underestimation of the work involved in keeping spaces of possibility open, holding them open, so to speak. Now, it could be the case that both models are at work in Zion and Zion. It seems to me they're not inconsistent. So, for instance, we still need an explanation of why, within a history having people, some individuals are authentic and others not. But one could imagine a Heidegger who came to think that the collectivist model, as I've called it, captures what matters most. This meeting of a precondition of the possibility of authenticity that only a history-having people achieves. So you can imagine the possibility that the kinds of processes that collectivist model coming to strike a thinker like Heidegger as more important, looming larger in his thinking. So, could that be part of the story? I don't know. Thank you.